So good afternoon. Welcome to the first High Notes of the 2019 season. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. We are in the PEPCA Auditorium at the Aspen Institute. And these sessions take place at noon every Wednesday. I'm saying this not for the people in the auditorium who seem to know that already, but for people listening on radio, because these are broadcast, I believe, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on Aspen Public Radio, the voice of classical music in Aspen. We're grateful to them for that. They're also available as a podcast, whatever podcasts are, I don't even know. But if you know what podcasts are, then these are available. I'm delighted to be joined by two wonderful guest artists in the festival, but when I say guest artists, that's not really the best way to think of Joyce Yang and Simone Porter. Both of them were very notable students in our program here, and both of them have made that wonderful transition into having worldwide careers, and we're very proud to bring them back to Aspen in the summers as guest artists. So welcome. I thought we would start by talking about music. It just seemed like an idea to me. Joyce has several projects with us this summer. She has already played the Gershwin Piano Concerto with the Aspen Festival Orchestra last Sunday. We're not going to talk about Gershwin. But this evening, she plays a recital in Harris Hall. It's at 8:30 p.m. And it's a mixed program with chamber music, solo performance, and piano duo. Let's start very briefly with the chamber music. It's Mozart's piano quartet in G minor. I did not envision talking a lot about Mozart, but if, in case you came in wishing to talk about it, this is your chance.
I think Mozart quartets, I've been playing both of them quite a bit with the Alexander String Quartet and recorded it last year. And throughout the process, we really ended up focusing on the humor aspect of it. And there are always one or two places when we perform it live, someone in the audience goes, ha, 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 in the middle of my little cadenza that I add or certain inflections I do, there is that little bit of humor around surprising corners, which I think is humor in music, and trying to fulfill that. It's one of the hardest things to do, and every performance with different groups just seem to be very, very different. So this is a new rendition tonight. We've played in different pieces, but as this four of us, it's our first time, so we'll have fun. I'm not sure exactly what kind of humorous moments will show up.
Well, then I take it back. We're going to talk about Gershwin after all, because it seemed to me, and I think to many people, that Sunday you were just having the most wonderful time playing that Gershwin piano concerto. Is that true, or were you an actress?
Well, my philosophy backstage is like, I made it this far, might as well have a good time. I mean, it's the worst time, 20 minutes leading up to the concert, and those stage manager comes and says, 10 minutes, that's just deadly, and you just want to run in the other direction as fast as possible. But in that last 10 minutes, you have to compose your thoughts and say, I did everything I did to get ready, and only thing left to do is really just let go of all control and see what sticks and what kind of adventure we can go on, given I've already spent hundreds of hours analyzing everything to death. So this is the one opportunity I get to have fun. So there is that that will and that thought process before, but it actually ended up being one of the most, let loose kind of experiences of my life, where I actually, the fear went away in pockets of the performance, and I sort of forgot that, I was on stage expected to play everything perfectly. That sort of desire to be just right left, and you sort of end up really opening one door after another. And I think, yeah, we came together quite well, and that's, you feel that from either the beginning, or that moment never comes, but it arrived very early. So that sort of let me relax a little bit. And and I had a ball. And you're having a good time when middle of the third movement rolls around and you're like, oh no, it's almost over. did I do everything I wanted to do, or is there some strange thing or new idea that I can fit in before I have to disappear? So it's you feel it's like leaving a theme park or something that you're like, no, but one more time, I want to go on one more ride. So it was a great time.
Wow. Okay, let's follow that. I have so often heard teachers say to students, and I've often said this myself to people backstage, you have to say to yourself, I am ready, I prepared for this. A classic performer's nightmare is to be backstage and to forget what work you're going to play. So let's ask Simone, do you have any stories about this or any insight into how you feel in those 10 minutes before you're going out?
Absolutely. You know, it's exactly what Joyce was saying about the 10-minute call. It's a run for the hills moment sometimes. But the thing that has really, I think, gotten me into it on stage, the sort of key insight I have is to think of a performance as a constant creation rather than a replication. I think when I get on stage and I feel like I need to replicate what I practice, when I need to just present something that I've already created, that's when it gets dangerous. It can be stale. And also if something is divergent, then it feels wrong. So if I think of it as a constant conversation with other people on stage, something that's open to spontaneity, just something that you are creating as you go throughout, it requires a type of focus that I think really grounds you, keeps you interested, and puts your mind in the right place, because then you're just allowing yourself to be inspired by the music in the moment rather than trying to control every aspect of what you're delivering.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. We have some beautiful video, and I think it's on our website, of your teacher, Robert Lipset, here. And I think it's with Fabiola Kim, and so I could be wrong about that. But it's in the studio, and she's getting ready to play a concerto in front of, 1,500 people. And Bob says, I think you're ready. And I think that's the most wonderful thing a teacher can say is, now you're ready, go out there. Let's go back to Joyce's music, because this evening then you're going to play a set by Carl Vine, and probably most people don't know anything about him.
I think he's probably the most celebrated Australian living composer. I first played his first sonata when I was about 15 years old, and I think it was about 10 years later that I got an invitation to come to Sydney, Australia, to give a solo recital under one condition, that I play a piece by Carl Vine and he will be in the audience. And it really is, when you analyze a piece of music, try to understand a composer for so many years, spend so much time trying to understand it, and then the composer suddenly sitting there, it is a little bit different, but it is like meeting Beethoven. It's very daunting, it's very scary, and you feel judged, and he's sort of this bigger than life in my mind. And actually, our first meeting didn't go so well. After the concert was the first time he heard me. And during intermission, I played it right before intermission, he came backstage and he said, I think that was so great. Not what I wrote.
But, no.
But what you did was excellent. And so it was a rocky start, and I really went to his studio and worked out what was really against his vision and what I needed to do to the sonata to make it more what he meant to express. And over the years, we became good friends, and Landa Preludes that I'll play tonight is a piece he gave me a few years ago, and he wrote on the score, you absolutely must play this, and no one really does, and I think it suits you perfectly. And I learned it, and it's in 12 miniature movements, and it comes with these wonderfully funny and sarcastic little poems that he wrote for each one of these movements. And it has each one's titled, sort of like Schumann's character pieces. Each one's of completely different mood. And I think it's something you absolutely must hear once or more. But I'm very excited to share that because, again, in that as well, it has incredible humor and it's just such a variety of texture. He hears music in textures, never in colors, he said, but they're either slimy, sticky, bumpy, spiky. You know, he uses these words, so understanding his music has a lot to do with what would it feel like on your fingertips.
Simon, do you have any stories about working with composers? I think composers are so nice. I don't know why anyone is, you know.
It absolutely is daunting, but it's also quite a privilege. I think, you know, we spend so much time trying to decode what was the composer actually trying to convey. So having the opportunity to actually just ask somebody to play what you think to them and actually have them say, you know, this is the origin story behind this. This is actually what I was thinking about this is pretty incredible. I had that for the first time, really, a year ago. I played a piece by Esa-Pekka Salonen called Lachen Verlernt, which is a 10-minute solo violin piece. And I had the opportunity to perform it for him. And I was shaking in my boots. I mean, I was really, really terrified. But getting to hear the stories, getting the validation of saying, oh, I like it this way, of just hearing the sort of creative impetus behind the whole project was really rejuvenating in a way. And it actually really transformed the way I approach all music, sort of interpreting something that was required a fluency in a type of music that I wasn't as familiar with, really refreshed my perspective when I applied it to, standard pieces that I had heard and concertos I had played many, many times. It allowed me a sort of vision which was sort of back to the basics, really looking at a score, really looking at a piece of music, taking it on its own terms rather than baggage that can sort of accrue through the years of just hearing it over and over and over again.
Thank you. So then the second half tonight is all Rachmaninoff. And first I want to tell a little Rachmaninoff story, how he relates to our season theme of being American. I said this on Sunday, but I think I would like to repeat it for the radio audience. While no one would think of Rachmaninoff as an American composer, he actually made his home in America for the last 25 years of his life and became a US citizen. So he is literally an immigrant composer. He did not do what some composers did. He did not adopt any American style or mannerism or affect. The same you could say of Schoenberg and Stravinsky and even maybe Bartok, who all lived in the US, as opposed to say Kurt Weill, who really changed when he came here and began writing in what he took to be a more American style. Anyway, so first Joyce plays a group of preludes, and the preludes were written in his Russian period. They were written early in the 20th century while he lived in Russia. Then the symphonic dances are one of his great American period works. So I don't know if you have any initial comment about the preludes, the symphonic dances, the style?
They do feel very different to me. The preludes are about nostalgia, longing. There's a lot of unfulfilled melodies that go on for a long time, only to be left with a hint of loss and saying, is this what it was all about? Especially the third prelude I'll play, I just feel like after all the drama, he ends with the question mark. It's like, is this where it ends up? Mm-hmm. And the Rachmaninoff symphonic dances for me are much shorter strokes. That sort of long, broad melodies do exist, but what really sticks out are these very delicate underlying, of course, dance, all kinds of undulating rhythms, but they're much more of these dramatic little strokes that are borderline schizophrenic, but all these bats come out in the middle of the darkness and create this fantastic new surprises and many, many jagged turns. It's never this long journey that sort of is unfulfilled. It's a constant roller coaster of unexpected gestures that start appearing left and right. So it does feel like visually looks very different in my mind.
And the symphonic dances, although you would guess from their title, are written for a symphony orchestra, Rachmaninoff himself made the version for two pianists, and the other pianist tonight is the wonderful Konrad Tau. So I was seeing an interview, a different interview with you recently, and you were talking about the touch for Gershwin, that there was a very different touch that you found than you would for, say, Chopin or Schumann. Do you find that in your own preparation, or is it because you know that's the style, or how does that happen? And what about Rachmaninoff touch?
I think in Gershwin, the jabs, what makes it jazzy to the listener are the syncopations most of the time. Instead of relying on the downbeats, it's what happens right after the downbeat. So instead of one, two, three, four, it's one, two, ta-ta, ta-ta. It's that jab that happens right after the beat. And in order for those to pop, I felt that it's imagining a sound and doing whatever with your hands that would create the sound that you hear in your head. So I think always you have to hear the sound that you want, imagine the sound that you want, and try to find the technique that fulfills that sound. And I had never really played accents this way. I used to play it with a lot of tension in between my fingertips, and it was a fast strike down. It was a pressing of the keys as fast as possible, as sharply as possible. But I found out that Gershwin syncopations work much more jazzily if I jab my fingers into the keys, almost like I'm taking out the notes from the keys. So it's not up from the air down, but it's from the keys up. So you're always starting on the surface, and it's almost like you got electrocuted, and then you pop up from the keys, and that's the touch that I use to get that jazzy sound in my mind. So when you do that with the orchestra, you have to be sometimes the really small gestures, the small accents get lost with the orchestra. So as you work with them, they become bigger and bigger. And my body is just not used to this new movement. And different muscles get affected after the rehearsal, and you do feel it on your body. In Rachmaninoff, it's a bit different because it's, for me, I would say Gershwin in my mind exists 3 inches off the ground, and we're somewhere a little bit not really controlled by gravity. We can defy gravity. We're constantly, sort of flying on a magic carpet a little bit. All these melodies, when they roll out, I feel like we're completely defying gravity. Whereas the Rachmaninoff symphonic dances, the big accents are, we are drilling to the core of the earth. It is going as deep and as fast and as effective and as jarring as we can get with 2 concert pianos on stage. And that's one of the movements I fell in love with as a kid, when I could just sit on the piano and then bang. Not that we bang on it now, but that movement with the gravity going down, putting your hands on the keys and making that roar of a sound. And when you hear 2 pianos do it, I think it's much bigger than the whole orchestra string section. There is something incredibly angular. There's something cold about these accents, and they are... For these accents, I almost stand, so all the weight really goes to my fingertips. The weight of my back, my shoulders, everything, I'm basically standing on the hands to create that almost metallic sound that has no bounce. It shouldn't have this tam-pa-dam-pa-dam-pa, this kind of Gershwin bounce. It's like pa. It always has this flirtatious end to it, and this has to be pa, 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 pa. There can't be anything sort of flirty at the end of it. It has to be so final, and so it does feel very different on the body.
So Simon, Joyce says a beautiful thing to me about first imagining the sound she wants to have and then finding the physical gesture or the physical presence that will give her that sound. Is that resonant for you with violin?
Yes, absolutely. I think having sort of going into the idea world and imagining the sound that you want without any of the physical things that you actually have to navigate to produce sound is where you have to start. If I start from what all the details that it takes to produce a particular color on the violin, I feel like I will just be lost in a cascading mountain of like details because, oh, I have to move my bow, a millisecond this way. I'm going to vibrate a tiny bit. None of that matters. I think all of our technical training is ultimately a means to an end so that we can get closer and closer to approaching that idea that we have initially without thinking about how it's actually happening. So that's something I do. That's something I do a lot in the Prokofiev that I'm playing on Friday, without a doubt, just because I think that sound world is very particular. I know we're about to talk about that, but the Prokofiev starts with a marking that says sognando, which means as if in a dream. And so that sort of ethereal, whispered, misty sound is something I thought a lot about. And before going on stage, I try to put myself in that place just mentally. The beginning to me sounds almost foggy. It's as if the notes, the phrases are materializing or becoming substantive right when you reach them, or almost because you reach them, they sort of shore up into existence. So that is a very mental picture, and I think the idea of that is more important than worrying about the execution.
Well, so let's go into Prokofiev. You will play Prokofiev's first violin concerto with the Aspen Chamber Symphony this Friday, which is July 5th, 6 p.m. in the tent. And it's a very special work. You've already talked about that it opens as if in a dream. So I can think of many Prokofiev works that open as if on a battlefield. So why do you think it has that structure? And maybe talk a little about the three movements and their mood.
Yeah, so I think of this concerto as basically a journey through a fairy tale. So I think, honestly, the entire piece could be prefaced by Once Upon a Time. It all could exist under that umbrella. It has that marking, like it said, as if in a dream at the very beginning, and it has another one of my favorites. About 2 minutes in, it has another marking, narrante, which means narrating. So I think of myself in this piece as almost a tour guide through the dreamscape. After that misty opening, it crescendos, becomes a lot more tangible, but it's like these weird entities and spooky spectral figures are rising from the dust, the ashes, the fog of the dream, and you're encountering all these sort of weird entities, and it eventually just crescendos and crescendos and becomes almost nightmarish, I think. And that, there's a very special part at the end of the first movement that comes back at the end of the third, in which the violin is whispering at the very, very top of its register with other instruments that are also sort of creating this ethereal texture. The end of the first movement is a sort of a trio with the flute and the harp for a while. And at that point, when I was really thinking about this, like, what is this story? How does this relate to everything that got us here? I think that Prokofiev's depiction of this dream went from being focused on the action to the texture itself. So to me, rather than showing, the who, what, where of the dream, I think this is as if he was transcribing ether or something, like we were really feeling the substance itself. So I think it's a magical work. It's a little interesting in that the first movement is dreamy, the third movement is dreamy. They have their own sort of dramatic arcs, big climaxes and whatnot. But the second movement is the presto. It's whip fast. It's about 3 minutes long. It's less, I guess, what you would call dreamy. It's kind of described as nightmarish, I think, by a lot of violinists, just because it's infamous. But that's sort of where you get a little, some of the puckish Prokofiev humor. A lot of it comes out in that movement, but it's a magical piece. There's a lot of symmetry between the first and third movement that makes me think of it as entering and then recollecting a dream. But it's one of my favorite concertos to perform because it feels like such a narrative journey. Amazing collaboration opportunities on stage with different members of the orchestra, with the conductor. So I have my first rehearsal tomorrow and I'm very excited.
Great. I'm going to tell a little story about the premiere of the Prokofiev Concerto, only because it allows me to say many wonderful names that I like saying. But Prokofiev brought the piece in Russia before the First World War, and he wished for it to be played there, and it didn't work out. And then he was in Paris and was able to arrange what became the first performance of the work, not with the violinist he had intended, not with the conductor he had intended, but the conductor turned out to be Serge Koussevitzky. And it was on a concert where Stravinsky also had the premiere of his octet for winds. Now, people think about the Rite of Spring as if it was this famous disaster and failure, but that's absolutely not true. It was the choreography that people hated, not the music. And in fact, the music was quite a sensation at the premiere of Rite of Spring. And the next big concert was this one with the octet. Now, the octet is one of my favorite works, but it's a completely different work. And so, however, the Parisian audience came to that concert ready to love the Stravinsky, and they did not love the Prokofiev. It seemed too sort of wispy and, you know, dreamy, and then they had Stravinsky. So, however, in the audience was Josef Tsigeti, and he decided, well, I love this concerto. So he decided he would take it to the States. Meanwhile, the Russian performance got organized, and it was Natan Milstein with Horowitz playing the orchestral parts on the piano. And to the end of his life, Milstein, who, by the way, was here in the first ever Aspen Music Festival in school in 1949, but Milstein always said, I would rather play with Horowitz than any orchestra. I don't know how conductors felt about that. In any case, that's my story. I thought we would talk a little about careers. Because despite your extreme youth, both of you can be said to really be solidly in your careers now. It's not a, you know, what will happen next, how is this going to turn out kind of thing. But being in my position, I'm always interested in the strategies that people take as they enter their careers. So for instance, at what point do you have management? How do you get the management? Because there are competitions that give you management for short periods, and then sometimes you just audition. But then I said the word competition, and I see that some people have a really pivotal experience with competitions, and some people essentially never enter them. I was talking with Conrad Tau about this. Conrad has really never done a competition. So I thought we would ask Joyce first. You famously were the silver medalist in Clyburn, and that was an important moment. Did you do lots of competitions? Did you do only that? How did that work?
That was my first and only very big international piano competition I was involved in. I grew up playing just a small little things here and there that got me some wonderful gigs out of it. But I was pretty much a, I'd like to say a regular kid, but I did have a manager by my side since I was 13 years old. I was in pre-college of the Juilliard School, and I had the opportunity to represent the pre-college division by playing Prokofiev's third piano concerto with the school orchestra and Leonard Slatkin. At that time, I didn't know who he was, so he was not intimidating at all. And I played for this event in which time one of the big agencies came to the dress rehearsal. And after that concert, I signed with them, which meant I would travel every few weeks and play concerts all over the place. My mom came with me because I was 13, 14, 15. And it was something that was really fun, no pressure at all, really. I remember thinking I really do have to do a good job, but it wasn't at all a nerve-wracking thing. It was a fun road trip that we kept taking together, my mom and I. And it continued like that till the Clyburn, which happened when I was 19. And getting the silver medal meant that I would get another set of managers giving me concerts. So it was a bit strange. I think I was one of the really very few that came in with a management that I already worked with. And it was a jarring time after I got the silver because I had to, of course, fulfill the role of the silver medalist, which was about 50 concerts a year for the next 4 years. And this has been done and dealt with and already in different organizations' programs. My name wasn't on there, but they signed up for the silver medalist, the controversial one. Why didn't she get the gold? You know, anyway, so there was a full schedule that I had to fulfill, and it was a very weird feeling because suddenly everyone wanted to hear me, and I had to fulfill my own set of concerts that was already planned for me even before the competition. So I ended up going from, I don't know, 15 concerts a year to 70 overnight. And also I was enrolled in the Juilliard school, and this was after my freshman year. And my sophomore year, I was a full-time student, which was very overwhelming. I was, you know, really in school less than half the time, but I made up every single hour I was gone with a TA. So that meant not many hours left at the end of the day. And very challenging time just because I also had to explain to people why you should come hear me. And I had no answers. You know, it's what makes your playing so special. And I was like, I couldn't tell you, you know, I wish I knew. So it's a very confusing time. So that happened at 19, and I've been doing, I think on average, maybe about 60 concerts. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's 45, 50. And 2 years ago, it was almost nearing 100 concerts. Mm. So they all sort of average out to be about 60, 70 a year. And that's been really happening for 15th season. So after about 50 cities a year and 15 years in a row, you know, I can't really believe it's been that many places and that many cities. But as for strategies, I think the only strategy and the only thing that keeps me going is like constantly coming back to pieces I want to play and doing projects that really mean a lot to me. Even though some things I know I can do well, if I just feel terrible after playing that piece, no matter how happy the audience is, if I'm miserable, my performance will suffer in about 3 performances and it'll be downhill from there. I have to be just totally high on the piece I'm performing night after night. So it's really staying true to what I truly believe in, what I really think people should hear and where my heart is. And at the end of the performance, I should never feel like I told a lie. that was my truth, and if you hate it, what am I going to do? You know, that was also the way of dealing with critics, that of course you're going to get some critic that say, like, I didn't like it, that was terrible. And you read that, and when what you played in the concert wasn't your core, if you feel like you kind of did Look What I Can Do, or you lied a little bit, or you kind of tried to sound like another pianist that you want to sound like, or there's something, an extra layer there, you get very overly sensitive. It's like being zapped. You know, it's like someone caught my lie or something. It just, you can't, it's very hard to get over that. And not reading my own article these days, it's kind of impossible because my mom's going to forward it to me the next day. So it's dealing with all that is at the end of the day saying, I did what's in my heart, I gave it my all, and that's what came out. And if I get crap for it, then that's all right. You know, but you have the fuel to keep going to the next concert.
Well, I'll tell a little behind-the-scenes story. We in Aspen have a contract with the Cliburn, and so every 4 years, we agree in advance to present either the gold or silver medal winner, and that's the way it's written. And so in Joyce's year, we said, yeah, we'll take Joyce.
And one more thing, I've always had trouble playing solo recitals. Pianists sometimes love that power to control absolutely everything. That is really one of the awesome things you can do as a pianist, to play a solo recital. Soliloquy of all your voices interacting with each other, digging into like absolutely the private place where it's what you really want to say shows up on stage without any outside influence other than the breath of the audience members. But I always felt that I was happier, maybe better as a collaborator. And something like tonight, it's really, I can't do that very often, do a Mozart quartet and then do a two piano program in the second half. These things are very hard to do on the road, to hire people to just play 20 minutes with me. And, you know, it's only happens here, this kind of a colorful program where I get to, yeah, play with awesome people. It's, I'm so happy it's a hybrid program, and my nerves are much happier at this hour of this concert day.
Great. So, Simon, your pathway into the career was different, I think. And if you could talk to us about the care you and your teacher took and auditioning for conductors, and what did you do?
Right. So I also had no experience with competitions. I didn't do any major competitions when I was sort of building a career. I think the ultimate lesson I gleaned from the way that I got into getting solo engagements and whatnot is that the word or the idea, labeling it a solo career, is very apocryphal because it's such a collective endeavor. There's one person or standing on stage, but ultimately the behind the scenes, which is what actually counts, is a massive amount of effort and support from mentors, from teachers, from administrations, from institutions, organizations, parents, I mean, just so many people. So my sort of come up basically just taught me how many people it took and how to be grateful for just the amount of effort that people took really in supporting me. So I started playing concerts when I was young, almost sort of before I realized what was happening. Violin started as a hobby to me and evolved very organically, I think, into a passion and ultimately a vocation. So there came a time when I was a kid, when I was about 12 or 13, when I really had to choose to commit to violin as the most important thing in my life, you know, beyond regular school, beyond just everything else that I loved and cared about and still care about. And it was a hard choice, but at the same time, it was, you know, the easiest decision. It had already been made. And at that point, I already knew the violin was the love of my life. I moved down to Los Angeles to study at the Colburn School when I started flying between Seattle and LA when I was 12, and then moved to LA when I was 15 to study with Robert Lipset, who is here in the audience. Colburn was what really transformed my career and my playing. My work with Mr. Lipset obviously completely revitalized anything I thought I knew about myself as a violinist or a musician. And Colburn as an institution and organization really vaulted my career. Colburn had something called Colburn Artists, which was an in-house management, and it basically existed to be sort of a stepping stone. So it allowed students who already were getting concerts, who had a number of connections or whatnot, to experience the business side of music, but within the safety of the school, so that the emphasis was dual on business and on education. So I was involved with that for a number of years, in which, and that was really when things started to bubble. It was during that time that I played my first solo concert at Aspen. I had come here as a student for 7 years, and then made the jump, the terrifying jump, to playing on stage in the tent. And after that stepping stone management within Colburn, I started talking to and sort of starting to pick on the interest of more sort of official management companies, which I made the transition to when I was 18. So at that point, it was still all about building connections. Like you said, one of the ways to do that was playing for conductors. So music directors or conductors who, you know, have the programming capabilities. I would audition for them, play certain repertoire, get to know them that way, and that introduced me to concerts, and it sort of worked from there. And at this point, I still very much consider myself an aspiring violinist. A lot of things are still very new. I just got done with a year and a half that was all about new repertoire. So I learned 6 concertos, which was kind of a whiplash. One of them was Prokofiev 1, but building up a repertoire is definitely a sort of key part, I think, of starting a career. You have to have key things and things that you love in your fingertips. And now I have more of that, so now I get to tackle the existential questions of what kind of artist I want to be and what are the programmatic things I want to do in projects and whatnot. So it's just sort of, as I said, just as on stage is a constant becoming, I feel like a career, and certainly at this point for me, is also just lots of discoveries and becomings all the time.
So you are still officially a full-time student, is that right?
No, actually, as of a month ago, I am not. Okay. Yeah. I went to Colburn up until last May, and now I am unmoored from student life.
a story I like is many years ago, I was working with Midori. She had not gone to college when she was, 17 or 18. She was already playing too much. And then at a certain point, she thought, I would like to do that. So there was a program. I was at New England Conservatory, and there was a growing program with Harvard. So you could be a Harvard undergrad and a New England Conservatory grad student at the same time. And we explored whether she could do that. And at a certain important point, she said, I would be willing to cut to 75 appearances a year in order to be able to do this. And we at New England Conservatory said, that sounds great, sure. And at Harvard, they said, are you kidding? So in the end, it was NYU that agreed to make that possible for her. Anyway.
You know, I have a very different high school experience. I remember I wasn't sure if I was gonna really do music, actually. When I was 17, senior year in high school, I remember going to my guidance counselor, and I was like, and she said, what schools do you want to apply to? And then I was actually toying with the idea of, majoring in physics. I mean, I was really into other things, and I think because my parents weren't musicians, and they're both scientists, and this musician in the family was very new, and I had to, get really good grades, because I think in the back of their minds for a very long time, I was going to have this music as a strong hobby. And it was only at 17 that I looked at my guidance counselor, who was not in any kind of music-oriented anything, and I was like, you know, I think I'll just stick to music. But even still then, I was like, is this something I want to devote my life to? So when I heard you say, like, when you're 12 or 13, that you said, yes, this is what I want to do, I wondered what aspect of it were you most drawn to? Or was it it was music, or it was violin? For me, those were very different things. Mm-hmm. It was like piano as a toy, and then music came way later. And it's like, oh, wait, these two things are connected. You know, this never occurred to me until deep into my teenage years. So I just wondered what...
That's really interesting. You know, I had the same thing. My parents aren't musical either at all, which is something I was grateful for, because my parents are both professors of international studies. So they were stage parents about, like, getting good grades and being eloquent and being intellectually curious rather than, you know, playing in tune or something. at that point, I don't think it was as separate to me. I saw just a life in the music world and violin as something that I really wanted to pursue. The thing, honestly, that I feel like changed me the most was really coming to Aspen when I was 10 years old and 11 for the first time, because that was the first time I was surrounded by other young kids who loved doing this, who were absolutely willing and eager to, you know, nerd out about symphonies, about music, classical music repertoire, who made it funny, who incorporated everything to do with being a kid and playing into their music making. And those were sort of bifurcated in my home life, where I played a lot with my friends at school, and then, you know, my music life was something else, was sort of separate from my social life. When they cohered in Aspen, that opened up completely new vistas for me about what collaboration meant, what it meant to be inspired by colleagues and to share both the fun aspect and the serious musical aspect with people, and see that the seriousness wasn't so rigid as I thought. So that changed everything. When I was sort of making the choice, it wasn't really a choice between enjoyment or, like, being a kid and music. The music world had opened up, and I saw that it could contain a multitude of experiences. And I guess I saw violin almost... my violin was just like the automatic ticket into that. I didn't really see them as separate entities.
Well, you talk about your parents, and we've talked about Bob Lipset, your teacher. Your teacher for much of your life has been Veda Kaplinsky. Veda is chair of piano at Juilliard and dean of the pre-college at Juilliard, and also a wonderful member of our faculty here in Aspen for many years. The other night you were telling a funny story, the outlines of which are you and your mother, barely knowing Veda, I think, rent the house next door to her in order to have just an inundation of lessons. And Veda's report on this was, I thought I was wasting my time. I thought nothing will come of this. All this information I'm giving will not stick at all. And then when sometime later, you'll tell us how much later it was, you showed up at Juilliard, Veda said it was astounding. It was as if every word I had said had become a real thing for this young person. Then I want to get to your mother's comment about piano teacher.
Renting the house next to hers is a really big deal, because we were living in South Korea and she lived in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. So, so we traveled quite a ways to rent that house that was available next to hers. I mean, I was 9 years old, so I didn't know it was a big deal. And we got so lucky, because they got 4 feet of snow or something like that summer, so she couldn't leave the house. So we could, you know, make our little way to the house. So she saw me every day, because she was home every day. And so got super lucky, and every day for several weeks, She worked on my technique. When she first heard me about 6 months before that, we were just on family vacation in New York and had this incredible serendipitous meeting with Veda. And she heard me and she said, you had terrible technique. I had to help you because you were still trying to tell a story with your terrible technique, with sound. And so she... when I saw her for those 3 weeks, it was, she held my elbow and I was playing one note at a time for hours, next note, and she was shaping my arm and my hand and teaching me a completely new way to play the piano. And after that week, of course, we don't live in America, so we went back to Korea, and she suggested I take lessons with a few of her colleagues that live in Korea, and I was a very serious student. I do remember that's the period when I really heard for the first time. It was like the earplugs came off, and I was really asked to listen. It's like now more like the first time, but now, you know, a little bit more on your pinky. Do you hear the difference? You know, this kind of listening process was unknown to me until that point. I was just playing as quickly, as impressively as possible, and everyone seemed to be impressed, and it was just an activity, not really about music. So when I came back to Veda, I think that was the biggest difference. I was listening. I was really hearing what happens between the notes and trying to create colors and with the technique that she taught me, it did stick. So I was able to actually play what my head was hoping my fingers would do.
Well, I'm going to do a quick detour into neuroscience, if you don't mind. There's a thing that happens when you're practicing any physical activity. It's certainly true in sports. It's absolutely true in music. Is that the repetition of the activity does something to the nerves, which is called myelinization. And it sort of habituates, but it's an actual physical thing that happens in your nerves. However, an astounding finding in the neuroscience of music is that imagining musical sound myelinizes the nerves also. And so you can practice by imagining, and then, as a musician was just saying to me last week, then you are myelinizing with a perfect performance, as opposed to the merely physical way in which it's just sort of a rough and tumble thing. So I like that about your that physical activity of finding the action you want.
And older I get, I think more I spend time not practicing physically, but thinking. Mm-hmm. And now the memory, performing by memory has never been an issue when I was little. And never really thought about it, never really second-guessed it, and older I get, it's like I get more and more nervous about my memory, and I'm finding many new ways to cope with that, and one of which is really to not look at the piano and try to imagine the music in my head half the speed, and I should be able to remember absolutely every note without any muscle memory. I cannot look at my hands or have my hands moving in any way. And that's sometimes very, very difficult. And to go a step further, my friend Augustin Heidelik, who will be here, he said, well, for my memory, for the violin concerto, he plays piano quite well, but he plays the piano, he plays his line, violin line, on the piano with one finger. And he... that's when he can do that. He knows he can. He knows it by memory because it has nothing to do with his muscles or the left hand. And in that same way, I'm like, how can I apply that to the piano part? I play very badly on the violin. So I always try to play what happens in the right hand with the left hand. Oh. And what happens on the left hand with the right hand, that's very revealing of what you don't know, really know. Mm. And then that's step one, and then it gets 10 times more neurotic than that, but I won't get into all that.
Simone, do you have any practice strategy like that?
No, I was just going over my Prokofiev in my head. I was like, do I really know this? Like, I've never had any problem with memory, but Like, it scares me on stage. I will be playing something I've played, you know, so many times in so many contexts. And all of a sudden, I'll think to myself, do I know what happens next? And of course, you know, it's like asking yourself, when you think do I know what happens next? Then of course you don't. So I do a lot of score study too. I think that's also something that I've done more and more as I've gotten older and as I've gotten more familiar with certain repertoire, that thinking about it, really thinking about the phrases aids your memory and your interpretation and your comfort so much, I guess. So for memory, I guess I just hope that I have it mentally and muscle memory and yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, if you're awake during the work process, I think it's no problem.
I think so.
If you actually practice like you're performing on stage and worry about everything, then you know, all your analytical skills have figured it out already. But it's when, you know, sometimes it's like driving, not that I drive, still that's something I have to learn to do, but it's like you zone out and then you end up at your house, you know, and you don't know where you made the turn. That is a kind of muscle memory. And we sometimes practice like that. We're thinking about, oh, what should I have for lunch? And then suddenly you're at the end of the piece. And that'd be great if that happened in the concert, but in the concert, you're like, well, that note, and then what? And then what's the next note? And then you become all crazy. And for that to calm down, you have to have that neurotic process in the practice room. But I actually found this will seal the memory 100%. And I've actually never talked about it. I think I told maybe two people, but this really works. And this is a really great way to use your airplane time when you usually don't have Wi-Fi or a good book. For my Liszt B minor sonata, which was daunting task for the first time. It's 40 minutes of with no break. It's a piece where many points in the piece, it looks kind of similar. So if you make the wrong turn, you end up in no man's land. 40-minute piece could turn into 5-minute piece. And it could go on for 2 hours. So anyway, you have to be very clear. And it's so emotional, so technical. Everything needs to come into that. And you have to be at the tip-top shape. And I was flying to Australia to play it for the first time. And I was just in total panic. I bought a rock and roll piano. It's a piano that goes flat on the table. The black keys actually come up a little bit, and you can plug your headphone, and it has two octaves that I can play my little neurotic things I still can't remember. And then right before that, I Xeroxed the entire score, and I cut every two measures, and I put it in a box or whatever. And then on the plane, I would take out two measures at a time of, like, you know, 78 pages of music. And then I have to, as quickly as possible, identify where that is in the score. I would be like, okay, that's sort of 20% in the left hand, does that. And that's the hard part. But if you really want to know it, you have to pick the two measures out, and then you have to know what comes two measures before that two measures. Oh. That's really hard.
Okay. So you are scaring me now.
Oh my God, me just too.
This takes about 10 hours to get through one piece. And oh, if you can do that, no problem on stage.
Yeah. Okay. I am sticking to my day job. Now, I actually have so many fantastic subjects left to talk with Simone and Joyce about, but our time is up, and usually we do questions, and I am so sad to tell you there's just not time to ask any questions. But I did want to first of all, because we referred to it, or I did, at one point your mother, having spent hours and hours and hours and days and weeks and years with Joyce and Veda, said, I think I could be a really great piano teacher.
My mom sat through every lesson of mine, and she had her own score, and she didn't read music very well, but she started to play the cello same time as I played the piano, so we would go to lessons together in the very beginning. But she would write every comment that she heard, and very often they're on sticky notes because she's not sure exactly where it was. But many years later, yeah, she's like, oh, I could teach, no problem.
And then a final thing. Joyce mentioned her love for special projects, and of course last year we had the ballet, the Schumann with Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, which was a national tour. But Simone, you also have some unusual projects, and I thought if you would just give us 30 seconds on Esapekka and Foreign Bodies. That was a beautiful thing.
Sure, absolutely. So the piece that I mentioned I got to play for Esapekka Salonen was called Lachen Verlernt. The title means Laughing Unlearnt, and it's this really, really cool concept. I loved the piece musically and conceptually because it's taken from a line of Schoenberg's Pierre Lunaire, in which the narrator is basically beseeching the sad clown Pierre to help her reclaim her laughter, which she feels she has lost. So the whole idea is that the performer is a metaphor for Pierrot and can sort of serve as this conduit for emotional excavation, soulful reconnection. So I was involved with the project involving that piece that combined that with dance. So this was at the New York Phil at the end of Salonen's Composer in Residence, and it was a program that was almost entirely his music, and I played this not on stage but up in one of the boxes in David Geffen Hall, and there were two dancers on stage. So it was the entire night was multidisciplinary, involving dance, involving music, involving visual art art components. So I loved that. I love all sorts of projects that really tap into these synesthetic connections between all different art forms. So being part of that was fantastic. The hardest part was just I wanted to watch the dancing. I really wanted to know what the choreography was going on, but that was not an option at that time. So, but that was definitely a highlight of a season.
So thank you, Joyce Yang, tonight, 8:30, and Simone Porter, Friday, July 5th at 6 p.m. Thank you.